This is edition number 2027 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 24th of July 2026. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 23rd of July 2026. My name is Barbara Calver and my fellow readers are
Sue Jay,
Clive McCombie
and Julie Reeve.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 5 o'clock and will set at about 9 o'clock.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes articles about a guitar made from Neolithic bog oak, a Tudor treasure at Oxborough Hall, festivals and exhibitions, and finally, creatures of the deep.
But we begin with the main news items, which include shelter row is resolved, recycling centres see influx, poor public transport holding back economy, new police and crime commissioner, Cromer praised, woman rescued from burning boat, first GBR Anglia trains, fire triggers explosions in home. Let's start with those lead stories.
Railway bosses say they are relieved a resolution has been found to the long-running bus shelter dispute in Sheringham. North Norfolk Railway said in a social media statement that it had remained neutral throughout the debate over the future of the much-loved bus shelter at Station Approach, which was torn down last week. It was finally demolished to make way for a £580,000 travel hub scheme proposed by Norfolk County Council, but the railway said that the suspension of the works since December on the hub had affected its operations. The not-for-profit said it had agreed for the track bed crossing its land to form part of the travel hub, as long as the plans did not affect railway operations and buses continued to stop at Station Approach. It said it required permission to access its own land and written approval for train movements across the track it owns. The organisation welcomed the restart of works and said it looked forward to buses operated by Sanders Coaches returning to Station Approach. Its statement said, "We hope people will therefore appreciate that in common with most stakeholders, we are relieved a resolution has been found." It also said the issue had been unnecessarily politicised and urged local organisations to focus on promoting tourism in Sheringham and across the North Norfolk coast. Sheringham's 1950s bus shelter was demolished on Monday, July 13th, with plans for the new travel hub to start. Sanders Coaches has confirmed it had received permission from the Traffic Commissioner to resume all services from the Station Approach stop from Sunday, July 19th. The firm said timetables would shift by 2 to 5 minutes to accommodate the return, and it has also tweaked a handful of services based on customer feedback. The 4:30pm Route 9 from Fakenham will now leave at 4:40pm to suit local working patterns, while the 5:48pm Route 9 has been pushed to 5:51pm to help passengers connecting from King's Lynn's Lynx services. The 4:10pm Route 15 from Cromer will now depart at 4pm, better matching closing times at Fellbrigg.
Officials say Norfolk's recycling centres are coping well despite an influx of electrical items being taken to them after a partial ban on such waste was finally lifted. Norfolk's recycling centre started accepting all electrical items again last week, ending a temporary ban which had been put in place following a major fire. The council's 19 recycling centres had been forced to limit the items after an April fire at Wiser Recycling at Thetford, which Norfolk County Council used to process many of the electrical items which people take to tips. The company then stopped operating after it lost its treatment facility approval, leaving County Hall with no legal way to deal with much of the electrical waste. The council had to apply to a national scheme to be appointed a new contractor, which took some time to conclude. In the meantime, recycling centres were able to accept washing machines, tumble dryers, dishwashers and cookers. Later, they were also able to take cookers, TV monitors, laptops, but not smaller electrical items, batteries, light bulbs and fluorescent tubes. Council officials had urged people to hang on to the electrical items in the meantime. Even before the fire, TIPS had stopped accepting fridges and freezers because of national capacity issues in recycling such items. But since last Monday, people have been able to take all electrical items to TIPS once again, including fridges and freezers. A spokesman for Norfolk County Council said, "Since we restarted collecting electrical items at our recycling centres, we have seen more electrical waste than usual, as was expected. However, we have not required additional staff and customers have been able to book a slot as usual at all of our sites this week. People can also now get rid of batteries at TIPS once again, which council bosses say is the safest way to dispose of them. They have long urged people not to put them in with the general rubbish as, when compacted in bin lorries, the cells in some batteries become damaged, causing fast, fierce and sometimes fatal fires. People who want to dispose of electrical items at TIPS need to book slots at recycling centres online through the council website."
Poor public transport is holding back the East's visitor economy, a new study has found. In 2024, the region attracted 70 million tourism trips, generating a visitor spend of more than £4 billion across over 12,000 businesses and supporting 158,000 employees. Despite this, a new study by Transport East found that limited bus and rail options, particularly in rural and coastal areas, as well as services not being aligned with businesses' opening hours, are reducing visitor satisfaction, making it harder for firms to recruit and retain staff, and placing strain on communities during peak periods. It also found that the region's reliance on cars is contributing to congestion and parking pressure, and there is also insufficient accessibility for disabled people and those with additional needs. Sharon Payne, Rural Mobility Lead at Transport East, said, "It's clear that further attention and action are needed to better ensure transport plays its part in keeping the visitor economy growing." The study recommends targeted transport improvements to support growth, including better timed services, expanded demand-responsive transport and shuttles, and greater lift-sharing schemes. Longer term, it calls for stronger east-west rail links, closer alignment of transport and tourism policy, and a regional integrated fares system to simplify and reduce the cost of travel. Pete Waters, Executive Director at Visit East of England, welcomed the findings. He said, "While public transport in Norfolk and Suffolk is good, we need it to be better. That is why we fully endorse this new report from Transport East. We are behind the recommendations and look forward to working with them to achieve a more sustainable network for visitors and local communities." Transformation of these insights into actionable projects will form the next phase of the work, with a focus on building integrated, accessible and inclusive travel options for all.
Norfolk's new Reform Police Crime Commissioner, PCC, has targeted rural crime as one of his priorities after his election. Colin Sutton, said resources sucked up by Norwich and market towns needed to be spread more fairly. The former Met Police detective, who received 32,647 votes, some 14,000 more than his nearest rival, said, "Rural crime is a concern. I think farmers and agricultural communities have had it really rough in recent years. We need to make sure they're not experiencing thefts of equipment or hare coursing on their land." Mr. Sutton, who lives near Diss and is Reform's National Policing and Crime Advisor, added, "There's a feeling that Norwich and the big towns are sucking all the resources in when lots of other parts of the county need them. Norfolk has an excellent police force, but too often it has ignored our rural areas in favour of our city and towns. That will change, and I will ensure that Norfolk Constabulary is a police force for the whole county." Mr. Sutton, who retired from the police in 2011, said his knowledge of policing meant he knew what is needed to hit the ground running, although he acknowledged he would need to understand how the force operates. But he said, "I think there are some areas where the public thinks it does not get the attention that it deserves. I cannot just throw money at every problem, but there are sometimes ways to do things slightly differently." Mr. Sutton becomes Norfolk's fifth and, as it stands, final Police and Crime Commissioner, succeeding Sarah Taylor in the £76,000 a year post following her resignation last month. But only 17.14% of the public, 122,739 of the 716,224 electorate, headed to Norfolk polling stations to vote for a post which is due to be axed in 2 years. The election is estimated to have cost £2 million to hold, meaning it cost £16.29 for each person who voted. That was the second lowest turnout for a countywide election in Norfolk's history, with only the first PCC election in 2012 lower, when turnout was just 14.5%. Mr. Sutton won with 32,647 votes, with Conservative Matthew Taylor second with 18,343. Green Martin Schmeyer was third with 16,907, with Norfolk businessman Margaret Piercy, who ran as an independent, fourth with 16,402. Labour's Beth Jones secured 14,192 votes. Restore Britain's Mark Buckton garnered 13,319, and Liberal Democrat Chris Brown was in last place with 10,499. The Police and Crime Commissioner's powers include being able to hire and fire the Chief Constable, while they also set the Constabulary's budget, including how much in council tax goes to the police. They publish a police and crime plan, setting out the force's priorities, and commission services for victims of crime. But the post is due to be abolished in 2028, when the powers pass to the new mayor for Norfolk and Suffolk. Ms. Taylor stepped down from the post in June, saying her family had experienced multiple bereavements and ill health, and that a close relative had received a life-changing diagnosis. She has since started a new job.
A seaside town with plenty of characterful pubs has been named among the best in the UK. Cromer has been ranked among the top 20 seaside towns in the country by The Times. The North Norfolk coastal spot was described as a traditional port town with a Victorian pier, pastel-tinted beach huts, a bucket and spade beach, and plenty of characterful pubs. For families visiting during the summer, it has lots to offer, with its choice of museums, arcades, a mini golf course, and plenty of spots to stop and enjoy classic fish and chips, followed by ice cream. It is also home to award-winning restaurants like Fino on Garden Street and Number One Cromer on New Street. Cromer's beach has been given plenty of recognition after it was named the best beach in the east of England by The Times and Sunday Times earlier this month. It took top spot after each site was rated using a 12-point checklist covering cleanliness, water quality, accessibility, parking, toilet and shower facilities, safety, dog friendliness and lifeguard provision.
Two people are in hospital and four boats have been wrecked after a major blaze engulfed a marina on the Broads. A couple, understood to be in their 70s, are being treated for burns after a fire ripped through their vessel at the Broads Edge Marina in Stalham. The woman ended up in the water after the fire broke out at around 7 a.m. on Friday. The blaze, which is understood to have ignited gas canisters on board, completely obliterated the boat and caused three others to go up in flames, totalling tens of thousands of pounds of damage. Sean Westgate, 54, and groundsman at the marina, said he'd been driving to work when he saw the smoke and helped rescue the woman from the water. "I saw smoke for miles away," he said. "We had a fire on the river and we tried to help a lady out of the river. She was wedged between the boat and the bank and two guys were struggling to get her out. We all grabbed an arm and lifted her out. She was in deep shock and crying. The wind was fanning the flames and that is probably why it caught alight so quickly." The blaze engulfed the couple's Princess 32 boat before spreading to three other vessels, which were unoccupied, moored at the marina. Fire crew and an air ambulance arrived on the scene within minutes, and it is understood the elderly woman was transported to hospital via the air ambulance. The couple both received minor burns. The inferno sent huge plumes of black smoke into the sky and across the marina. Carl Stevens, 57, and on a boat at the marina said, "We kept hearing popping and were setting up from the fishing deck. We saw flames and it was all quite fast. We heard fire engines coming. My brother noticed smoke, which quickly turned to flames. You can't help but feel for the people on board." Stalham on the River Ant is one of the biggest towns on the Broads and is home to several boatyards and marinas. A spokeswoman for Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service said, "We had the first call at 7:10 a.m. to a boat fire in Mill Road, Stalham. We sent crews from Carrow, Sprowston, Stalham, Wroxham and North Walsham. Four boats were involved. The stop message came in at 9:30 a.m. We are investigating the cause."
The first trains bearing the new GBR Anglia branding have been unveiled. They mark a significant step in the national rail transformation and will deliver visible change across the east of England. Class 357 C2C units 357008 and 357020 and Greater Anglia Class 720 units 720144 and 720501 were displayed in the new red, white and blue livery at London Liverpool Street Station. GBR Anglia now brings together C2C, Greater Anglia and Network Rail Anglia under one leadership team. The aim is to provide and improve reliability, resilience and customer service through closer integration of track and train. Jamie Burles, Managing Director of GBR Anglia, said, "Seeing the first GBR Anglia trains together at London Liverpool Street is a proud moment and a clear sign of the railway we are building. More importantly, the new identity reflects C2C, Greater Anglia and Network Rail Anglia increasingly planning and delivering as one railway. There is much more to do, but we have made a strong start. Our focus is on turning that progress into better journeys and a more reliable, responsive and efficient railway for everyone who depends on us." Progress under GBR Anglia includes approval for Greater Anglia Class 720 trains to operate on the C2C network, offering greater flexibility during service disruptions. Teams also work together to support thousands of Southend United fans travelling to Wembley, delivering stronger services between Southend and London on both networks. Over the coming weeks, more trains will be rebranded as part of C2C's existing repaint and maintenance programme. The transition will extend to station signage, staff materials, and customer communications. Existing services, ticketing, and customer arrangements will remain unchanged throughout the rebranding process. The internationally recognized Standard Express brand will be retained and rebranded as GBR Standard Express.
A tumble dryer is suspected to have started a fire that tore through a garage and sparked explosions. The blaze broke out in Cowslip Lane, Sheringham, and is believed to have been caused by a faulty tumble dryer that was due to be recalled by the manufacturer. The homeowner's neighbour, Chris Taylor, who is a photographer from the area, shared a video of the incident with permission. Mr. Taylor said, "This nightmare recently happened to a neighbour's house. The tumble dryer overheated and burst into flames. Minutes later, the garage looked like this." An accompanying photo to this article shows the garage engulfed in flames many feet high. Fire crews sprayed water onto the fire within 15 seconds of arriving. Mr. Taylor added, "I post this as a warning. Never go to bed with a tumble dryer running. Not that this was the case here. Check on it regularly and get a smoke alarm fitted in the same room." Things had started exploding as the fire crews arrived. Massive respect for the fire crews who turned up and operated with incredible efficiency and got the fire under control before it could spread to the rest of the house. It was a very close call. It is believed that the fire was caused by a machine fault, which is subject to a product recall that the owners were not made aware of. Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service confirmed that crews from Sheringham, Cromer and Holt attended the scene on June the 22nd. They used breathing apparatus along with jets to tackle the fire. The stop message was received at 10:33 p.m. The rescue service has reminded people not to waste water during the current hosepipe ban, not to use disposable barbecues and to always call 999 in an emergency. The warning comes amid a busy month for crews, with firefighters called out to more than 200 fires in the open in July so far.
Our next few news stories include: wheelchair user can reach beach more easily, 30-mile charity run, Reform defends stance, bishop to lead historic service, short film, clock tower repair, gritter spotted, and teenage violinist.
Free beach wheelchairs are now available on Sea Pawling Beach for people with mobility issues. The scheme was launched by Sea Pawling and Waxham Parish Council and aims to tackle the barrier wheelchair users face to get beyond the promenade. People who have previously had to wait at the ramp or cafe are now able to reach the sand and the sea. Sue Hutchins from Hoverton used the new wheelchair. She said, "We all used to come here as a family and I have missed doing that. Being able to do that again is absolutely great. It is a lovely feeling. I am just part of the family again." The parish council received positive feedback from a family who used the new chairs. A terminally ill woman was able to revisit Sea Pawling for what may be the final time, spending the afternoon on the beach collecting pebbles, eating fish and chips, and enjoying the coastline she had loved since childhood. Two chairs are currently available, including an adult model and a smaller version suitable for children, and can be booked online or at Sandy Hills Snack Bar. Bookings run daily from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. with collection from Sandy Hills.
A Norfolk charity trustee has helped save the sight of a much-loved family dog after rallying the local community behind a remarkable fundraising effort. Neil Featherby, owner of running shop Sportlink and one of Norfolk's most accomplished distance runners, joined forces with sports therapist Chaz Allen to complete a 30-mile solstice run from Felthorpe to Cromer Pier after meeting Ronnie. A 2-year-old Rockweiler, Ronnie, had developed a serious eye condition that left him in constant pain and in urgent need of surgery. Despite veterinary treatment, his condition worsened to the point where one eye had to be removed to save the other. His owner, Brian, had fallen on difficult financial times after his business struggled, leaving the family unable to meet the cost of the operation. Rather than stand by, Mr. Featherby decided to act. "I've known Ronnie for about a year, and it became clear he needed urgent treatment," said Mr. Featherby, who is also a trustee of Norfolk and Norwich Animal Support, NANAS. "People sometimes say if you can't afford a pet, you shouldn't have one. But life isn't always that simple. Brian had always cared for Ronnie, but like many people, circumstances changed. We couldn't wait and risk him losing both eyes." Mr. Featherby and Mr. Allen organised the charity run, setting off from Felthorpe near Horsford to watch the sunrise before completing the 30-mile challenge to Cromer. The response from all the public exceeded all expectations. More than £1,500 was raised through a GoFundMe appeal, with additional cash donations helping to fund Ronnie's surgery, medication and aftercare. A total of £500 was also contributed towards the operation by NANAS. Today, Ronnie is pain-free and enjoying life again. "You can see how happy he is now," said Mr. Featherby. "Every donation mattered, whether it was £5 or £200. Every single pound helped save Ronnie's future." Mr. Featherby hopes Ronnie's story will help shine a light on the work of NANAS.
Reform leaders at Norfolk County Council have defended their decision not to support work to pave the way for the axing and replacing of all the county's councils. Reform, which took control of County Hall after May's elections, has made clear that stopping Labour's local government reorganisation, which would scrap the County Council and the other 8 authorities in Norfolk, is one of its top priorities. The administration claims government ministers acted unlawfully in deciding the 9 should be reduced to 3, with unitary councils covering Greater Norwich, West Norfolk and East Norfolk. While officers at County Hall are talking to counterparts at district councils about how the transition would happen, the Reform administration told Local Government Secretary Steve Reid it would not support such work. And they said they would not take part in voluntary joint committees made up of councillors from the various councils to discuss oversight of the transition process. At a meeting of the County Council's Strategic and Corporate Select Committee, political opponents criticised that stance. Liberal Democrat Dan Roper and Green Ben Price questioned whether not taking part in those committees could put the County Council at a disadvantage. Reform's Robin Carter-Clark, Deputy Leader of the Council, said, "I am going to do all we can to ensure that we stop local government reorganisation and we keep the current system we have here in Norfolk. When it comes to voluntary joint committees, we've taken a political decision not to engage with them currently, because they are voluntary, first of all. They're a political talking shop in reality." He said, "Once the government lays orders which makes it law for them to attend the committees, expected later this year, then the stance would change." Sarah Roden, Director of Community Information and Learning at County Hall, said the roles of the committees was relatively minimal. She said the decisions on the design of services would rest with the new shadow authorities, which would be created next year, ahead of the start of the creation of the new unitaries in 2028. But Conservative leader Kay Mason-Billig, former council leader, said not being involved allowed the districts to set the pace and branded Reform's decision not to attend meetings as incredibly short-sighted.
The Bishop of Norwich is set to lead an historic service in the ruins of St Benet's Abbey. Later this month, Bishop Graham Usher will arrive by wherry to the Abbey, located on the River Bure in Horning. The service, open to all, will take place beside the wooden cross marking the former high altar of the Abbey. The tradition dates back to 1536, when every Bishop of Norwich also became the Abbot of St Benet's, making this annual visit a significant event. The service is organised by the St Benet's Committee, the modern-day heirs of the monks who lived, worked and worshipped here for centuries. The bishop is expected to arrive on Sunday, July the 26th at around 3:20 p.m, with the service starting at 3:30 and lasting approximately 35 minutes. The site traces its origins to 1019, when King Canute gave the land beside the Bure to a group of monks. The site is looked after by the Norfolk Archaeological Trust and is free to enter.
A short film starring an actor from The Crown has been shot on the Norfolk coast as the production transformed a quiet beach into ancient Rome. Filmed in Weybourne but set on the Ionian coast in 44 BCE, Augustus tells the coming-of-age story of Octavius as he learns of the death of Julius Caesar. The film stars Flynn Edwards, known for playing a young Prince Harry in the hit Netflix series, and was co-produced by Norwich-based Ember Films. It was written and directed by Ed Whelan and is set to be released in 2027. Production took place over 5 days, with 4 spent filming along the coast and 1 in Norwich. Sam Topley, founder of Tarot Productions, said, "We had an incredible few days in Weybourne with a brilliant crew. The beach gave the film scale, atmosphere and texture, and the local support made a very ambitious short possible. Local professionals were recruited through Norfolk Screen to support the shoot. Further along the coast, Cromer is set to become a film set later this year for the Bright Side Running Club, starring Maxine Peake and Gemma Jones. Based on a book, the film explores friendship in the face of a cancer diagnosis."
The clock tower, which forms the centrepiece of Blickling Hall, is to be restored after suffering from years of weather damage. The timber structure, which rises above the Grade 1 listed Jacobean stately home, has endured water ingress, decay and long-standing maintenance issues. Surveys found the tower, which dates to around 1830 and is the third to stand at Blickling, had deteriorated due to poor ventilation, a leaking roof and paintwork which traps moisture. Plans put forward by the National Trust and approved by Broughton District Council include replacing damaged timber cladding and mouldings on a like-for-like basis, repairing lead coverings and introducing a new rainwater management system designed to cope with extreme weather. This will include larger downpipes, overflow measures and a modern internal drainage system to prevent further water damage. New discrete anchor points will also be installed to allow safer access for maintenance, helping to reduce the need for more invasive repairs in future. Historic England welcomed the proposals and said they would deliver clear heritage benefits and help secure the tower's long-term future. Set within a 340-hectare Grade 2 listed landscape, the clock tower remains both a functional feature and a defining focal point of the Blickling estate.
A gritter rolling through a North Norfolk village in the middle of a summer heatwave is not something you expect to see. But that is exactly what happened in Bodham this week. Locals along the A148 were left puzzled as the winter service vehicle made its way through the village. Councillor Callum Ringer said, rather than spreading salt, the gritter was laying granite dust to tackle bleeding tar caused by the region hot weather. High temperatures can soften road surfaces, forcing tar to rise and create a sticky, potentially hazardous layer. The granite dust is designed to absorb the excess tar and protect the road surface from further damage. Mr. Ringer said, in a social media post, the road through Bodham has deteriorated during the heat, prompting the intervention. Drivers have also been warned they may see the gritter out again in the coming days.
A teenage violinist brought smiles and memories in a heartfelt performance for a care home resident. Zoe Burton, 17, from King's Lynn, visited King's Court Nursing Home in Holt to perform for residents, many of whom were deeply moved by her talent and choice of music. Laura Bacorskate, hospitality manager at King's Court, said the performance was simply beautiful. Miss Burton, who attends the Purcell School of Music in Hertfordshire, played a selection of pieces designed to evoke memories and emotions, including Edelweiss, What a Wonderful World, and Moon River, as well as operatic works like Melody, Dance of the Blessed Spirits by Christoph Willibald Gluck. She began playing the violin at the age of 4, inspired by a family friend, and later found encouragement in the energy and positivity of 21-year-old British composer and musician Alma Deutscher. Speaking after a previous care home performance, Miss Burton said it was really special to play and see how much the residents enjoyed listening to her music. You are listening to edition number 2027 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday, the 24th of July, 2026. Still to come, the Mardler magazine supplement, but before that, this week's obituaries.
Catherine Morris, formerly of Northreps, passed away peacefully at Halsey House, Cromer, on July 8, 2026, aged 98 years. Dearly loved mother to Heather and Richard, grandmother to Rachel, and great-grandmother to Hugo and Florence. The funeral service will be held at Cromer Crematorium on Tuesday, August 4, 2026, at 12:30 p.m. Donations to Red Wings Horse Sanctuary may be left at the service. Family flowers only, please. All inquiries to Fox's Funeral Services, telephone 01263 512 427.
And now some local events. Thursday, the 30th of July, Wind Energy Museum Open Day starts at 10 a.m. The Wind Energy Museum reps with Bastwick. Also on Thursday, the 30th, Miniature Donkeys for Wellbeing visit Castle Quarter from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The friendly team from Miniature Donkeys for Wellbeing will be making a welcome return to Castle Quarter with their adorable four-legged friends, Castle Quarter, 100 Castle Meadow, Norwich. Info at castlequarternorwich.co.uk or 01603 766 430. also Thursday the 30th, Viking Crafts Family Event from 10am to 4pm, costs £3. Create your own Viking-themed crafts to take home at Lynn Museum, Market Street, King's Lynn. Information, lynn.museum@norfolk.gov.uk or 01553 775 001. On Friday the 31st of July, another Wind Energy Museum open day at Repsworth Bastwick. A coffee morning on the Friday the 31st, quill writing, 10:30am, is free. Join us for a relaxing hot drink, cake and activity, ranging from crafts to handling artefacts at Lynn Museum, Market Street, King's Lynn. A talk at the museum, The Town Walls and King's Lynn's Part in the English Civil War at 2pm costs £2. Discover how in the 17th century King's Lynn was the most fortified town in the East and how its ramparts, gates and earthworks have stood against armies and time itself. The Summer Harp Recital with Keziah Thomas at 3pm, free admission and parking, donations welcome at St Mary's Church, Church Lane, Antingham near North Walsham. Further information from steve.fordington@gmail.com or 0774 860 8441.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we learn about a guitar made from Neolithic bog oak, a Tudor treasure at Oxborough Hall, festivals and exhibitions, creatures of the deep, and finally, our roving reporter investigates a story of triumph over adversity.
KL Magazine, July 2026, Singing from Norfolk Soil. Buried for 5,000 years beneath Norfolk fields, an ancient oak has found its voice. In a traditional Georgian farmhouse tucked away in the lost lanes of Norfolk, 25 guests gather in a drawing room lit only by firelight and candles. The hearth roars against the cold night pressing at the windows as the music begins. Violin and guitar intertwine with a resonance that feels rich with history, like a recording from another age. Their timeless sound originates not from an Italian master's workshop, but from the fenland soils of Norfolk itself. When someone contacted me to say that a maker working deep in the Norfolk countryside wanted to build a guitar from Neolithic bog oak, I was completely intrigued, explains classical guitarist James Boyd. I'd heard stories about a violin he had made from the same timber. For a long time, it was a kind of will-o'-the-wisp, an idea that resonated with me, though I didn't know if it was actually a fine instrument or just a good story. James now performs on the guitar alongside leading concert violinist Hannah Perrone. Both unusual instruments were carved from the same ancient oak, buried for around 5,000 years before being unearthed at Rosedean Farm near Methwold. Jet black in colour and streaked with blue-black medullary rays, the timber is extraordinarily rare and incredibly hard to work. The maker of these instruments is Philip Taylor, who works from an old railway cottage surrounded by apple trees. Philip is a true craftsman, James says. From our first meeting, it was clear he's a very special human being, someone who makes things because it matters to him, not because he's chasing fame or fortune. James watched the guitar take shape, witnessing the moment the book-matched panels were joined and admiring the subtle intricacies of the luthier's art. We were both nervous when it was finally finished, he admits. I didn't want to have to tell him it was rubbish after all that work. He turned up with this beautiful instrument. There was a cleanness to the way he'd made it, a restrained simplicity. It was extraordinary. This Neolithic guitar was a world-class instrument with a captivating sound. Hannah was equally enchanted. She has played her professional violin for 25 years, an instrument made especially for her, but the bog oak fiddle cast its own spell. "I didn't expect that quality of sound," she says. "Oak isn't typically used for serious violin making or master-grade instruments." What elevates these instruments beyond the exceptional is not only their sound, but the story they carry. You can't ignore the fact that you're holding wood that was there when the Sahara was forming, Hannah says. It comes from a time before what we think of as modern man. It has witnessed so much, and it feels as if there's a mountain of story contained within it. When the two instruments were finally played together, neither musician anticipated the result. "It was as if they recognised one another," James says. "They could sing together. It was a very visceral experience." That moment sealed a collaboration now known as Black Ack, named after the Old English for black oak. James has long sought unusual, intimate ways to bring music to life. His song tellings weave together words, music, and personal story, while his wilderness concerts take small audiences to desert islands and woodland meadows. Hannah's path has been equally distinguished. Norfolk-born and Royal Academy-trained, she has led major European orchestras, including the Gewandhaus Orchester in Leipzig. She continues to perform in the more traditional classic music scene, but was also in search of something more connected. "Concert halls are wonderful," she says, "but this is about getting up close with people and exchanging something real." Their Black Ack events bring both instincts together. The programme draws on a Baroque and Romantic repertoire with Bach, Vivaldi and Elgar, threaded with James' narrative storytelling, poetry and the unfolding tale of the oak itself. In these intimate settings, the fourth wall dissolves entirely. Afterwards, musicians and audience sit together to share a meal and a moment that will become a lifetime memory. One person wrote to say the evening was pure alchemy, which it is for me too, Hannah recalls. Another said, "You tell your children there are certain experiences you remember for the rest of your lives, and this was one of them." These instruments, so rare and drawn from such ancient material, demand to be heard intimately, James adds. The oak is calling us back to a time when people told stories by firelight. To discover more about the black oak or commission an opportunity to hear these remarkable instruments, visit hannahperrone.com and jamesboyd.co.uk.
KL Magazine, July 2026. Home to the Beddingfield family for over 500 years and one of the National Trust's most treasured Norfolk properties, Oxburgh Hall has long been admired for its layered Tudor interiors, historic textiles and exquisite craftsmanship. Yet, as with many great houses, the collection that survives today is only a fragment of what once filled its rooms. Every so often, when luck prevails, objects and works of art find their way home. Agnes Beddingfield's portrait did just that, recently reclaiming its place at Oxburgh after being discovered, long forgotten, in the attic. A similar twist of fortune has now brought back an enthralling tapestry, which resurfaced unexpectedly after more than a century away from the Beddingfield home. It's incredibly exciting to be able to bring home one of Oxburgh's lost heirloom tapestries, says Shona Johnston, property experience curator at Oxburgh Estate. The return of Queen Esther offers a once-in-a-generation opportunity to present an exceptionally significant and well-preserved artwork in its original setting. Believed to have been woven in Brussels in the early 16th century, Queen Esther is one of seven tapestries illustrating the Old Testament story of Esther and Ahasuerus. Each panel depicts a different moment in the narrative. All seven tapestries were sold by the Bedingfields in 1924, with the other six yet to be accounted for. Many of these original Tudor spaces have been lost or altered by later generations, but the displays of Queen Esther provides a tangible link to Oxford's historic Tudor interiors, Schoner explains. It's beautiful. Vibrant colours speak to the wealth and status of the Bedingfield family in the early 16th century, when the tapestries most likely dates from. The return of this remarkable artwork also casts light on a more difficult period in Oxford's past. Although the collection was built during a period of wealth and confidence, long before Catholicism was outlawed, the estate's later financial struggles led to the sale of many prized heirlooms, including the tapestry series. Sold separately from the other six tapestries in the series, Queen Esther continued its extraordinary journey, spending time in Paris before reappearing in New York in 1992. After that, it vanished once again, slipping from view for almost three decades. Its whereabouts remained unknown until last spring, when National Trust research creator Jeremy Warren spotted it for sale at the Tiefe Fine Art Fair in Maastricht, Netherlands. How many other countries she visited in the meantime, we might never know, but we are beyond delighted to welcome her back to Oxford Hall, says cultural heritage creator Lucy Armstrong Blair. Securing the funding at such short notice was a challenge, but everyone involved felt the pull of a truly great story. Esther's return became more than an acquisition. It became an international effort to bring her home. Despite its age and extraordinary journey, the tapestry survives in strikingly intact condition. Its vivid colours suggest it may never have been displayed by previous owners, offering a rare, unspoilt glimpse of a 16th century masterpiece. To protect it for generations to come, the National Trust conservation team has undertaken detailed checks, including microfade testing, to assess how its pigments react to light. There will be ongoing conservation work to ensure that the colour and conditions are preserved, says Claire Goldborn of the National Trust's Textile Conservation Studio. This tapestry is of exceptional importance, and while the Trust holds several tapestries of a similar date, none match the style, quality, or condition of Queen Esther. Now hanging in Oxford Saloon, the grand reception room at the heart of the house, the tapestry is a sight to remember. With no glass barrier surrounding it, every thread is revealed, picked out by specially designed lighting that shifts subtly throughout the day to highlight different details. Charlotte Bedingfield's fine 1819 sketches of four of the tapestries are displayed nearby, bringing more of the story of Esther and Ahasuerus back into view. Visit Oxford Estate to discover more and see this woven wonder restored to the place it always meant to be.
Festivals and exhibitions, written and spoken by Clive McCombie because of some of the personal content. 2026 marks the 75th anniversary of the Festival of Britain and the 175th anniversary of the Great Exhibition at the Crystal Palace in 1851. Whilst the title of this is more general, I shall be addressing the two events which celebrate their important anniversary this year. The older of the two events celebrated Great Britain's leadership and inventiveness arising out of the Industrial Revolution, whilst the 1951 festival was intended as a feel-good story powered by Attlee's vision of Britain, a new welfare state, nationalised industries, and modern technology. It was intended as a tonic for the nation following the privations of World War II. The country and the world are in a bit of a state at the moment, so maybe it's fitting to refresh our memories of events that can never be cancelled. Turning first to the Great Exhibition, this was sponsored by none other than the Prince Consort, among others. It took place in a specially constructed building called the Crystal Palace. It represented a pivotal moment in the modernisation of architecture, using prefabricated iron and glass and mechanisation to replace much of what would have been created by manual labour. It also achieved this in a fraction of the time. The middle classes and the bourgeoisie thoroughly enjoyed the experience of their visits. But it was to be another 50 years or more before it replicated itself in architectural design more generally. Gothic columns continued to feature, and in iconic buildings such as the Norwich Station, bricks, mortar, and bespoke carvings in stone continued to be the fashion. The exhibition itself took place between May and October in 1851. And was visited by such luminaries as Karl Marx and Charles Darwin, and authors such as Dickens, Charlotte Bronte, Lewis Carroll, Tennyson, George Eliot, and William Makepeace Thackeray. The event was sponsored by the world's first soft drink manufacturer, Schweppes, originally founded in Geneva in 1783 by a German watchmaker. From the initial concept to the grand opening took just 9 months. The showcasing of all matter of items and inventions came from across the globe, was a great success, and made a surplus of £18,600, or about £35 million in present-day income. The average daily attendance was around 43,000, with a peak of 110,000 on the 7th of October. The surplus was used to fund the Victoria and Albert Science and Natural History Museums. The remaining surplus was used to set up an educational trust to provide grants and scholarships for industrial research. It continues to do so 150 years on. Such was the lasting impact of the Great Exhibition. The Albert Memorial to the exhibition, incorporating a statue of Prince Albert, is located behind the Royal Albert Hall. It is inscribed with the statistics from the exhibition, including the number of visitors, over 6 million, the number of exhibitors, 14,000, both British and foreign, and the profit made. A number of medals were produced and awarded to exhibitors, and this is where it comes closer to home. In our hall, I have an oil painting from 1852 of one John Smith. He was the father of my great-great-grandmother Selina. He, together with William Brewer, invented the watermark for which the Bank of England purchased the rights to provide an anti-forgery device on banknotes. They were awarded a medal in 1851. Where it is now, I know not. After the exhibition, the edifice was dismantled and relocated in 1854 near to Sydenham Hill, which was at that time in rural Kent. There it stayed until its destruction by fire in November 1936. Leaping forward 100 years to 1951, as has already been mentioned, the Festival of Britain was a socialist government's way of endeavouring to lift Britain out of the gloom of post-war rationing. It ran from May to September in 1951 and was intended to showcase a modern, recovering Britain and celebrate British contributions to science, technology, industrial design, and the arts. Unlike its forebear, it was a national festival only, though its showcasing was quite similar. International and Commonwealth contributions were not included. Whilst the festival was primarily centred on a London bomb site south of the Thames, it also saw other celebrations across the country. At about the age of 7, I remember such an event in my home city of St Albans. As an event, it was very popular, and people flocked to see the Dome of Discovery, at that time the biggest dome in the world, and the gigantic Skylon, which towered over war-ravaged London. There was a joke at the time which said that, like the British economy, it had no visible means of support. In addition to these attractions, there was also the Royal Festival Hall, and now, and for a long time, the only remaining feature of the festival. Unlike its predecessor, the festival made a net loss of over £8 million, or £220 million in present-day terms. In the autumn of 1851, as if to indicate the political rationale for the festival, Clement Attlee, believing that the festival would have contributed to future electoral success, called an early election to cash in. He lost, and the Conservatives did not wish to be associated with a socialist enterprise and propaganda. The festival was always intended as a temporary event, but the government ordered its rapid dismantling and scrapping of most of its structures, apart from the festival hall. This, they said, was to make way for urban development. If you are moved to, there is a short YouTube video in British Movie Tone showing the demolition and another on British Pathé. So how to set about comparing these two events? They were both at the time very popular and well attended, but the motivations for their taking place were quite distinctive. The exhibition was a showcase for Britain as a whole and demonstrated its preeminent position in the world of invention and modernisation. Whilst there were inevitably some naysayers, it was broadly supported by all segments of political and social opinion. As already mentioned, it was also financially successful and a glittering spectacle. The Festival of Britain's motivations were more opaque. It was clearly Britain-focused, and the political undertones were very near to the surface, as indicated by Attlee calling an early general election, the year following victory in 1950. It was also, of course, very costly and heavily criticised at the time when the population were enduring considerable hardship and privation. To my mind, the saying chalk and cheese comes to mind, but that's a personal opinion. What do you think?
Creatures of the Deep, taken from Kingsling magazine, July 2026. Look carefully into the shallows on a Norfolk beach this summer and you may spot something extraordinary. An alien-like creature pulsing gently through the water, trailing delicate tendrils beneath a translucent bell. Jellyfish have captivated and unsettled beachgoers in equal measure for generations, and their truth is even stranger and more wonderful than it first appears. A jellyfish has no brain, no blood, no heart, and is 95% water. Its digestive system is so simple that the same opening serves as both mouth and waste outlet. Yet despite this simplicity, jellyfish have been drifting through the world's oceans for around 500 million years, with fossilised imprints confirming their design has barely changed in all that time. Anna Bunny, citizen science programme developer at the Marine Conservation Society, has spent years helping the public engage with these remarkable creatures. They're strange, but they're amazing, she says. They're what we call passive drifters rather than powerful swimmers. They move by rhythmically opening and closing their bell to create a current, drawing prey like plankton, fish eggs, shrimps, and even other jellyfish within reach of their stinging tentacles. Washed by the North Sea and warmed each summer by the Gulf Stream, Norfolk's coastline plays host to a variety of jellyfish species. Sightings typically increase from May onwards, and any of the six species most commonly found in UK waters could appear along these shores. The barrel jellyfish is the one most likely to stop beachgoers in their tracks. It can grow up to a metre in diameter, roughly the size of a dustbin lid, Anna explains. Its milky white bell and frilly, purple-edged oral arms make it unmistakable, but it delivers only a mild sting. The moon jellyfish is perhaps the most familiar of all UK species. Its translucent, saucer-shaped bell reveals four distinctive horseshoe shapes at its centre, usually pink or purple in colour, and its sting is barely perceptible. It's frequently seen in large numbers, with nearly a quarter of all moon jellyfish sightings recorded by the Marine Conservation Society involving groups of 100 or more. The compass jellyfish is easy to identify. Bold dark brown, orange or red V-shaped markings indicated across its bell, and long trailing tentacles extend beneath it. This species delivers a genuinely painful sting, so keeping a respectful distance is advisable, Anna warns. The mauve stinger is another to avoid. It's small and exquisitely beautiful in vivid pink and purple, but the sting it gives is disproportionate to its tiny 10-centimetre frame. The blue jellyfish, with its deep violet dome and thick oral arms, is another regular visitor to Norfolk waters, while the lion's mane jellyfish is the giant of our local species. Most measure around 50 centimetres across, but they can reach an extraordinary 2 metres in diameter. A shaggy reddish-brown bell surrounded by dense, hair-like tentacles give this species its evocative name, and its severe sting makes it best admired from a distance. If you encounter a jellyfish in the water, just move away calmly, Anna advises. Leave any you spot stranded on the beach as you find them, both for your own sake and that of any curious dogs. That said, beach jellyfish do offer a rare chance to appreciate just how extraordinary they are close up, their colours, their tentacles, and the quiet strangeness of them. Jellyfish seem to have become more prominent in recent summers, but the data does not support this popular perception. The Marine Conservation Society recorded 1,327 jellyfish sightings across the UK and Ireland between October 2024 and September 2025, a 6% drop on the previous period. Part of the impression of growing numbers may come from more people looking, Anna explains. Social media makes it feel like they're everywhere, even if numbers haven't dramatically increased. Another factor is the appearance of so-called blooms, dense concentrations of jellyfish, sometimes numbering in the hundreds. These form when planktons thrive in warm, nutrient-rich water, drawing jellyfish together to feed and reproduce. What's certain is that jellyfish act as valuable indicator species. Unusual increases in numbers or earlier seasonal appearances can signal changes in ocean temperature or wider ecosystem shifts. The Marine Conservation Society's Jelly Watch programme invites the public to log their sightings online, with no specialist knowledge required. It's really easy and a fun micro-volunteering opportunity, says Anna. You can get the kids involved, counting them and using the ID resources. It's educational and it genuinely helped scientists. Sightings can be submitted at mcsuk.org, where identification guides make distinguishing one species from another surprisingly straightforward. Though most beachgoers might not want to get too close, jellyfish are beautiful and biologically extraordinary residents of Norfolk waters. Ancient survivors quietly telling us something important about the health of our seas.
morning, this is Sharon White and I'm here with Jane Ritchie, and we're going to have a chat about the Aylsham show and also something, a little talk about something very personal to Jane. I understand, Jane, this is the 78th show coming up at the end of August.
It certainly is. We've actually been running since 1946, so it should be 80, but we missed two for COVID and for foot and mouth.
And I know over the years, I know you've donated over £1 million, I believe.
We have, and we do try and do it to all local charities because they're smaller ones and they really need the assistance to keep going.
The Mardlow. I know we've fortunately benefited as well, haven't we?
Yes, you have. And I mean, it offers so much to local residents as well as those a bit further afield.
Yeah. And how long have you been involved?
Oh, you don't want to know. I started at the Aylsham show when I was 12. I used to ride my horses.
Goodness. Yeah.
But then I had a break for the family. But I have been back actually running the show horse section for about 25 years. It's a long while.
And talking of show horses, I know there is everything there, isn't there, from bite-sized circus shows. What else do you offer during the day?
Oh my goodness. Well, our primary thing to do is to offer education and farming. So we have an education part, but we also offer cattle, sheep, goats, show horses, show jumping. Then there's a lot of local support from various firms like Ben Burgess, but we also have things for the children, like a circus and a bit of a fun fair and lots of local food. But it's a real family day out.
Yeah. And I think I'm right in saying it's free for children under 16, isn't it, to get
16
in?
16 and which under is good. Are free.
That's unusual.
And we do run a family ticket, so they have a...
But I know, of course, agriculture sort of underpins Norfolk's economy, so all of that side of it is really important, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's nice because a lot of children nowadays really don't understand exactly where their food comes from. So we have been endeavouring to give them something to do, and they have fun doing it, but they also learn. Yeah. But we also last year had a massive drone, so of course that caused a huge amount of interest.
I bet it did.
But yes, and this year we have a great show. We have lots of attractions, and it hasn't really officially been announced yet, but I'm sure it'll be announced. So by the time this goes out, we've actually got a Battle of Britain flypast.
Oh, wow, well, that is something, isn't
so
it?
So that is really special.
It's very special.
We hope that people will enjoy it because we worked very hard to get this.
Yeah. And just a little bit more about what's on. I think you said little circus shows and children's fancy dress cookery theatre.
Cookery theatre. Then there's the owls and the falcons. We have the hounds there. We have
pony mounted games.
Yes, we're doing that again.
Lovely
completely
thing.
Mad, isn't it? Yes, completely mad. But we also have the jousting this year.
Oh.
And we have the parachutes.
You do. And a motorcycle display.
And the motorcycles, yes.
And also an art marquee for people that are into
flower marquee.
Oh, a flower marquee as well.
Which is all supported by the local flower club.
You have some sponsors, don't you? Look,
we are extremely lucky. We have lots of sponsors and we endeavour to support them and get people to support them. Obviously, it's all advertised around the showground. And we have the dance on the Saturday night when we make sure that all the sponsors are shown to people so they can see how lucky we are.
And talking of lucky, I know also you said you have some amazing volunteers that help.
Do you know, we have so many volunteers. We have in excess of 3,500 hours.
That's amazing,
of voluntary
isn't it?
Work done.
Yeah.
In fact, I suggest it might be more because we really only have one employed. And everybody else does it for volunteer. And I don't think you ever realise how much you do in your hours when you say add it up. A lot of the people that we support with donations, they do supply some volunteers for us.
Oh,
so that's great.
Well, now if we can move on to the next thing, could you tell us a little bit about your own sight loss journey, please?
I was very lucky last year to be president of the Aylsham show. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work out as we'd expected. Within a three-week period in June, I lost my sight. I was in hospital for nearly 3 months, on and off. It It was my immune system attacking my immune system. Were brilliant. They tried everything, but unfortunately it didn't work. Saying that, I've been very well supported. I have to say the Aylsham show actually gave me something to focus on because I knew I wanted to be there on show day. And I really did. I have to say the day after I was tired. I really gave me something to focus on.
Yeah.
It was what I needed. The Vision East have been fantastic in support, as have the RNIB. And I'm currently training for a guide dog.
Oh.
I've nearly passed and hope to go to panel in about 2 weeks' time. And then we will start having a guide dog when there's one available.
So what does that mean when you say go to panel?
Right. I have to learn 3 different routes I can walk on my own without a dog, without a person. So currently, I could walk you around Stalham and tell you all the shops, take you to Tesco's. I could take you to
Shopping's
North...
always good.
Oh, yeah. I could take you to North Walsham. Yeah. I could walk you around North Walsham, tell you all the shops. I could walk you through the churchyard, take you down to Sainsbury's, take you back. Then we'd come back and go to the post office, go around by the fire station, go to the library, go up into the park so I could give the dog a run, and then go back to the car park. And then I do one locally here where I can walk out, go for a walk down Weaver's Way and come back again. Oh. I have to be able to do that before they will consider me for a dog because that dog doesn't know where it's going.
Well, no, and it's weird, isn't it? Because we know how much training the dogs have to go through,
yes.
But it hadn't certainly occurred to me that you would have to do some preparation
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you are granted a dog and when the dog arrives, it comes for a sleepover, then you go off for 2 weeks on your own with the dog in a hotel.
Ah.
And you bond.
Yeah.
Then they come back here and they come out to you every day. And you learn your routes with the dog. Both the guide dog people and Vision East have been amazing.
Yeah.
But I'm pleased to say that when I was poorly, I lost all my immune system. But they've now built that up and I have an immune system again.
Oh,
so I'm very excited.
So you're not more prone to getting anything else than you would have been before?
No, not now.
Good.
So I'm still working with Aylsham Show because it gives me something
that's good.
To do.
And will you be there this year?
I will. My
Wear
daughter and I are running
dresses. Because you look gorgeous, isn't it? You'll be doing the horses?
Yes. But then we're both giving up after this year. I still intend to be working with Aylsham Show. I've been asked to do some other things. I do intend to work with the guide dogs. They've asked me to do some various bits, like promotional work.
Yeah, oh, brilliant.
Moving forward, I would very much like to work with them. Apparently, I have a positive attitude.
You certainly
do. So
there
we go.
For
but
sure
yeah,
you
no,
do.
We will carry on and do as much as we can because I'm now trying to raise funds for that sort of thing.
Well, it's been absolutely lovely chatting with you. And just to recap, it's Monday, August Bank Holiday, 31st of August, Aylsham Show.
Correct.
Really, really worth a visit. There's so much going on there.
Is.
And people
I
can
just,
maybe meet you as well.
Yeah. May I just say thank you to the Mardler. They've been incredibly supportive of me. What you produce every week is phenomenal. It really lifts you, particularly when you first have this. It really gives you an insight into what's going on. So thank you very much to the Mardler.
Well, thank you. That's lovely to hear.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out details on our website mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Preston. Editing and producing this issue was Manny Gomez. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!